Hello, lovely Buddhas. Continuing with volume 1 of the New Human Revolution, today we'll be reading pages 98 to 117. From the day the ruling Liberal Democratic Party forced the vote on the new security treaty, the area around the National Diet compound was packed with more than 10,000 protesters daily. The demonstrators ranged from intellectuals to lantern-carrying housewives, attesting to the breadth and scope of anti-security treaty movement. It was only natural that the issue became a topic of great interest among the Soka Gakkai Youth Division members as well. One day, towards the end of May, Shinichi Yamamoto was engaged in a conversation with some representatives of the young men's division. One of them said to him, "With the new security treaty now such a big issue, I was wondering whether the Soka Gakkai shouldn't also express a consolidated position on the matter." With a smile, Shinichi responded, "Well then, let me ask you this, are you against the treaty or are you for it?" "I'm solidly against it. I think we should do away with the security treaty and take a neutral stand in international relations." At this, another youth spoke up. "I can't say that I completely approve of the treaty, but I think that it's an unavoidable necessity for the time being. Right now, Japan is incapable of standing on its own militarily or economically without US cooperation. If we abolish the treaty now, Japan will create ill feelings with the United States. Therefore, to talk about scrapping the security treaty at this stage is to ignore reality." Other young men expressed their opinions too, but their responses divided them into two camps. Shinichi looked at them warmly and said with a smile, "Do you see how much the opinions vary just amongst yourselves, the members of the youth division? Though you are all Soka Gakkai members, you have many different ideas about the security treaty. Some of you are for it and some against it. And no matter which side you choose, each has its pros and cons. The Soka Gakkai cannot tell people what to do with regard to the security treaty. I want as much as possible to respect all of your opinions." The Daishonin's teachings, of course, say nothing about the security treaty, so isn't it permissible for various thoughts on the matter to exist within the Soka Gakkai? Politics and religion occupy different spheres. The foremost mission of religion is to cultivate and nurture human life, which forms the basis for everything. The Soka Gakkai is a religious organization and, as such, will not be declaring its views on each political issue that arises. I think we should trust our fellow members who have been elected to sit as representatives on the House of Councillors and leave what needs to be done politically to them. Nevertheless, even if it be in the sphere of politics, should a fundamental problem arise that, if ignored, will definitely cause unhappiness for the people and lead to the destruction of peace for humanity, then I will speak out. Better yet, I will take the lead and fight in the forefront. The youth's eyes sparkled. On June 10th, amid rising anti-security treaty protests, President Eisenhower's press secretary, James C. Hagerty, arrived in Japan to coordinate final plans for the president's scheduled visit later that month. As Hagerty's car prepared to depart for the American embassy via Haneda's airport's main exit, it was surrounded by a sea of demonstrators. Members of the anti-mainstream, pro-communist party faction of the militant Zengakuren Student Federation and labor unionists opposed to the security treaty. With demonstrators rocking the vehicle and climbing onto its roof, Hagerty and his party were held under siege for more than an hour until a U.S. Marine Corps helicopter came to rescue them. The incident caused a stir not only in Japan, but internationally as well. Hubert Humphrey, U.S. Senator and Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, lodged a stern protest, calling the episode a direct insult to the American people. It was 5 days later, however, on June 15, that the most tragic and painful page in the history of the 1960 movement against the security treaty was recorded. That evening, groups of demonstrators from the radical mainstream faction of the Zengakuren, as well as from the labor unions and the New Theatre Alliance of anti-traditional dramatists and actors, each began marching towards the National Diet compound. Suddenly, scores of ultra-rightists, arriving on trucks emblazoned with banners, surged into the crowd and began attacking the protesters. In the ensuing melee, it was the members of the New Theatre Alliance, many of whom were women, who sustained the greatest injuries. Armed with wooden clubs, the rightists randomly struck the fleeing demonstrators. The authorities were slow in responding to the sudden outbreak of violence, a fact some viewed as evidence of the police officials' tacit approval of the extremists' outrageous actions. The vicinity around the diet was filled with close to 20,000 demonstrators who had been summoned there by the mainstream Zengakuren faction and other groups. When the students heard about the violence and the delay in police intervention, they assumed that the rightist attack had been instigated by the Kishi administration. Implementing their plan to storm the diet, the Zengakuren leaders shouted, "Charge!" Enraged students then broke down the gate to the south entrance and set to work removing a barricade of police trucks that had been set up just inside, finally managing to gain entry. Police turned powerful water cannons onto the crowd, while the students responded by throwing stones. The air between the two sides bristled with a menacing intensity. Baton-wielding police, who had been waiting in the shadows of the Diet building, launched themselves on the students entering the compound. There was a thunderous roar of angry shouts intermingled with screams of agony. Students were even clubbed from behind by police as they attempted to escape. Some slipped and fell in the pools of water caused by the police water cannons and then were trampled by scores of other students. The water became tingled with blood. Tragically, one student died in the turmoil. Her name was Michiko Kamba, a literature major at the University of Tokyo. Shinichi Yamamoto was at the Soka Gakkai headquarters when he heard the news. The tragic loss of the young student, who had participated in the demonstration out of her hopes for democracy and peace and her concern about Japan's future, weighed heavily on Shinichi's mind. It also deeply pained him that the student demonstrators and the police, who had been dispatched to disperse them, all fellow youth, had had to spill one another's blood. Prospects for repealing the security treaty, now that it had been passed by the House of Representatives, the lower house, were almost nil. Through the process of automatic ratification, it seemed inevitable that the treaty would become law 30 days after its passage by the lower house, just as Prime Minister Kishi had planned. When that happened, it would also signal an end to the battle against the security treaty. Where would the students direct their energies then? Shinichi wondered. Though he had been concerned about their movement getting out of hand, he was also keenly aware of the purity of spirit that motivated them. For this very reason, he hoped that each youth would continue to live for the sake of peace and democracy. If, with the passage of time, they were to forget their original purpose, then the death of that one young woman would have been in vain. Filled with pain and grief at the events that had come to pass, he firmly resolved to create an era of genuine democracy and peace, hoping that in doing so, the young woman's sacrifice might also be vindicated. The day after the incident, the Japanese government decided that it would be inadvisable to have President Eisenhower come to Japan under the present circumstances and requested that his visit be postponed. Prime Minister Kishi then held a press conference at which he stated, "It is extremely alarming to behold the situation now facing Japan, where destructive forces of violence threaten to subvert democracy and our parliamentary system. The government is determined to stand up against such communist anarchy and assiduously protect democracy, which safeguards the dignity of human freedom. To do so, it is a matter of the utmost urgency that we take the necessary measures to maintain public order." Kishi's word displayed the arrogance of a politician unwilling to reflect upon his own responsibility. Wasn't it the LDP's forced passage of the security treaty, an action of blatant contempt for democracy and the parliamentary process, that served more than anything to fuel the flames of the people's anger? At midnight on June 18th, the new security treaty, without being put to a vote before the upper house, was automatically passed into legislation. At that time arrived, a hush fell over the crowd of demonstrators that had gathered outside the National Diet compound. "We declared the treaty void," a voice rang out over a loudspeaker, followed by echoing shouts from some of the students. But most just listened, their faces blank and lifeless. Some dropped to their haunches, as if their legs had crumbled beneath them, while some of the female students sobbed. All shared the bitter taste of defeat. The exchange of ratification documents for the new US-Japan Security Treaty took place on June 23, 1960, upon which the treaty went fully into effect. As soon as the treaty was in place, Prime Minister Kishi announced his resignation, and a new cabinet was formed under his successor, Hayato Ikeda, on July 19th. For Japan, this marked the end of what some called an age of politics and heralded the arrival of a new age of economics. Recalling these events of some 3 months before, Shinichi stepped off the plane at San Francisco Airport. The clock in the arrival terminal indicated 4:35 p.m. They were 2 hours ahead of Honolulu time. Several members had turned out to meet them. "President Yamamoto, welcome," a woman said. This greeting, however, was directed at Vice General Director Kiyoshi Jujo. Though the woman had seen Shinichi's picture in the Soka Gakkai's newspaper, the Seikyo Shimbun, she had never met him in person and could not immediately tell who the president was. She had mistaken Jujo, who had a more imposing presence than Shinichi, for the Soka Gakkai president. Jujo's face turned red as he pointed towards Shinichi, saying, "That's President Yamamoto." The other leaders travelling with Shinichi could not help being amused by Jujo's diffident manner. I'm sorry," the woman stammered, embarrassed at her mistake and repeatedly bowing her head in apology. "It couldn't be helped. We've never met," said a smiling Shinichi. "Thank you for taking the trouble to come and meet us." After offering these warm words of appreciation, he accompanied the others to the airport lounge. There, Nagayasu Masaki introduced the party from Japan to the San Francisco members, beginning with Yukiko Gilmore, a woman who had been playing a leading role in promoting propagation activities in that West Coast city. Mrs. Gilmore had taken faith 5 years earlier in Yokohama, Japan, and came to the United States with her American husband 1 year after that. Through her faith, during the short time she practiced in Japan, she transformed a condition of chronic illness, which had necessitated endless hospital visits, into one of robust health. Arriving in San Francisco with this experience under her belt, she had devoted herself wholeheartedly to sharing the teachings of Nichiren Daishonin's Buddhism with anyone of Japanese ancestry she encountered. She did not understand a word of complex or difficult theory. She simply possessed powerful confidence in faith, confidence that she had gained through her own experience. More than 10 people had begun to practice after listening to her talk about Buddhism. They also held discussion meetings, gathering together 3 or 4 members at a time. Though discussion meetings had indeed been held in San Francisco, they were far from resounding with the joy of faith. If anything, they had become a kind of commiseration gathering in which the participants consoled one another about their problems. The members who attended these meetings were having a hard time coming to terms with life in a foreign country and were desperately homesick for Japan. Whenever they met, they would naturally voice their dissatisfaction. Sharing their complaints, however, only served to deepen their misery, and inevitably the meetings would end with everyone in tears. After exchanging only a few words with Yukiko Gilmore, Shinichi Yamamoto could discern the great struggle she had mounted in conducting activities. He wanted to offer his wholehearted praise and encouragement to this woman who had, with all her might, been waging a solitary battle. "It must have been very difficult for you. Thank you for all you have done. Please don't worry. Everything will be fine from now on." Hearing his words, The woman's eyes grew moist with tears. Next, Shinichi addressed another woman from Japan who had been standing shyly behind Mrs. Gilmore. He was concerned because she looked unhappy, as if worn out by her daily existence. "May I ask your name?" he said. "Eileen," the woman replied. "Please, come on over and have a seat." Shinichi offered the woman a chair. Eileen was extremely tense. Her husband worked for the American military and had developed a severe gambling problem. He had run up an enormous debt and they were now virtually destitute. She had become physically and mentally exhausted and had even begun to contemplate suicide when, in June of the previous year, she had learned of the Daishonin's Buddhism. Like a drowning person clutching at straws, she had decided to join. "Are you practicing this faith wholeheartedly?" Shinichi asked her. "Yes, I'm carrying out faith like fire," she answered without hesitation. Although the woman had been taught that faith like flowing water was the model for strong faith, and that faith like fire instead meant faith that flared temporarily like a flame and died out quickly, in her nervousness she had inadvertently confused faith like fire as meaning a strong and passionate belief. "Oh no, it's just the opposite," protested Yukiko Gilmore, tugging at Eileen's sleeve. "I never taught you that." Shinichi smiled warmly. "It won't do for you to have faith like fire," he said. "But if you persevere with faith like flowing water, then you will definitely become happy." Shinichi's words were charged with confidence. With this single statement, Eileen felt the thick cloud of sorrow lift from her heart. Shinichi then spoke to the woman standing next to Yukiko Gilmore. "And may I ask your name too?" "Yes, my name is Chiyoko Taylor. In Japan, I was a unit chief in Kamata chapter." "Kamata chapter? I have very fond memories of Kamata. Do you perhaps know my wife?" Shinichi queried. "Yes, your wife came to discussion meetings at my parents' house several times with your children. Also, the first discussion meeting I attended was at the home of your wife's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Haruki." "Really? It's a small world, isn't it?" exclaimed Shinichi. "And your husband?" "This is my husband," she answered, pointing to the big man standing beside her. "His name is Paul. He works as an auditor for the federal government." She then added, somewhat apologetically, "But he doesn't practice yet. He does support my practice, though." "That's enough, isn't it?" Shinichi returned instantly. "He happily came with you to welcome us. Doesn't that make him an excellent member already?" At that moment, a beaming Paul Taylor offered a greeting in broken Japanese. "Konnichiwa." That is, good afternoon. "Oh, how do you do?" Shinichi responded in labored English, gesturing broadly. Shaking Paul's hand, he continued in his native tongue. "I'm so glad you came here with your wife to meet us. That's very kind of you." Yukiko Gilmore's husband, who stood beside Taylor, also reached out to shake Shinichi's hand. He had a dignified look. "Oh, thank you very much," Shinichi said in English. "Thank you for all your support." Looking genuinely pleased, Mr. Gilmore then responded in heavily accented Japanese. "Yamamoto sensei, o machi shitemashita," which means, "President Yamamoto, I've been waiting to meet you." "Thank you very much. I'd like to ask that you continue to support your wife and the Soka Gakkai." The two Americans seemed very amiable and good-natured. Shinichi presented Paul Taylor, who had yet to take faith, with a pin commemorating his own inauguration as president. Paul quickly put it on and displayed it proudly. He then held up a camera and said again in broken Japanese, "Minna de shashin torimashou," which means, "Everyone, let's take a picture together." It was a bright and cheerful welcome, in complete contrast to their lonely arrival at Honolulu Airport. Shinichi and the leaders accompanying him left the airport for the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, which was located on a steeply sloping street near Union Square. The 21-story building of classic architecture looked out over a typical San Francisco scene, complete with passing cable cars. After resting at the hotel for a while, Shinichi and his companions went out for dinner with the Gilmores and the Taylors. They were taken to a tempura restaurant where menu items were written in Japanese on worn-out sheets of paper pasted to the wall. There was something modest and homey about it, a dining place for ordinary folks. The Taylors assumed that the visitors would have grown tired of Western-style cuisine by now and had chosen this restaurant to give them a chance to eat some Japanese food. Not usually able to afford the luxury of dining out on Japanese cuisine, the Taylors probably knew very little about the Japanese restaurants in the area. Although his traveling companions frankly thought that the restaurant was a little too Spartan, Shinichi himself was touched more than anything by the Taylors' sincerity and deeply appreciated their gesture. The greatest treat for Shinichi was to meet these two ordinary yet brave and noble women who had been striving to lay down the roots of Kosen Rufu in America. In return, the supreme treat for the women was to hear President Shinichi Yamamoto's heartfelt words of appreciation for their efforts and to see his encouraging smile. Though the meal was an extremely simple one, it was the first dinner meeting for Kosen Rufu to be held on the American continent. Shinichi also repeatedly expressed his gratitude to the two husbands. Though neither seemed to understand Japanese that well, when their wives interpreted what Shinichi had said, they nodded and smiled back, their eyes sparkling. During the meal, Yukiko Gilmore received a phone call. Several members had gone to the airport to meet the Soka Gakkai president and his party, but had arrived too late. Now they had assembled at the Gilmore's home. As he listened to Mrs. Gilmore explain the situation, Shinichi thought, the circumstances of these members must not be easy. It must have been a real challenge for them to find the time and means to travel to the airport to meet us. They probably worried the whole way whether they would make it on time. How sad they must have been when they arrived only to find that we had already gone. They must have been filled with disappointment as they made their way to the Gilmores. They are the ones who need my encouragement more than anyone now. It is my responsibility to encourage them. Shinichi wanted to go right away to meet the members, but felt that leaving in the middle of dinner would be very discourteous to the Taylors and the Gilmores who were escorting him. He saw no choice but to ask the women's division chief, Katsu Kiyohara, and Nagayasu Masaki to accompany Yukiko Gilmore to meet with the waiting members in his stead. He sent a message and some gifts with them as encouragement. Shinichi was always aware of the importance of each moment. Victory or defeat in battle hinges upon whether one seizes the initiative at a key moment. When it comes to encouraging friends, as well, there are crucial times when one must act. Shinichi was always quick to respond, taking prompt and timely action. His swiftness of response could perhaps be attributed in part to a keen sensitivity that had been honed by an intense determination to fulfill his responsibilities as Soka Gakkai president. He was driven by the thought that failing to seize the moment might result in a chance being lost forever. The importance of acting quickly was also something that he had engraved deeply in his life as a youth, when he had poured all his energies into serving his mentor, Josai Toda, while undergoing strict training as a disciple who would shoulder the future. After Kiyohara and the others had left, Shinichi said to Paul Taylor, I apologize for the commotion. I really want to do my best to respond to the sincerity of those who went all the way to the airport to meet us. Buddhism is nothing out of the ordinary. It teaches the true way for people to live and behave as human beings. As Chiyoko Taylor interpreted what had been said, her husband, Paul, listened intently with a serious expression. Then, his eyes shining, he smiled and extended his hands in a gesture of understanding, exclaiming in a mixture of English and Japanese, Oh, Buppo, that is Buddhism, wonderful. Tears welled in his wife's eyes. She had clearly been agonizing over how to get her husband to understand Buddhism, even if only a little. Her face showed deep emotion as she said to Shinichi, "Sensei, thank you. This is the first time I have seen my husband so happy listening to someone talk about Buddhism. To think that you will be coming to our discussion meeting tomorrow seems like a dream. I'm just sorry to say there aren't many members here in San Francisco." "That's fine," Shinichi said. "I've come to plant seeds. Tomorrow will be a new beginning." Chiyoko Taylor edged Shinichi's words into her heart. Shinichi and the other leaders spent the morning sightseeing around the city, while in the afternoon they paid a visit to the Japanese consulate. They then made their way to the Gilmore's house, where the discussion meeting was scheduled for 6:30 that evening. The house was located on Cole Street, set among a row of classic San Francisco-style residences with their distinctive bay windows. Shinichi and his party arrived at the Gilmore's shortly after 5 p.m. In a room that had been set aside for their use, they immediately began discussing the leadership appointments for a new district. The night before, Shinichi had informed his colleagues that he intended to establish a district here in San Francisco as well. He had then asked Vice General Director Kiyoshi Jujo and the others to come up with a blueprint for the leadership of the new district. Jujo now showed Shinichi their proposal. "Yes, that's the only possible choice," said Shinichi quietly. "Let's go with it." He continued, "On this trip, I also plan to set up chapters and general chapters in North and South America, because in the future, the sphere of our endeavors to propagate the law will encompass the entire world." The others could not believe their ears. Yet, since the district in Hawaii was established, they had come to realize that Shinichi possessed a monumental vision for Kōsun Rūfu that far surpassed anything they could imagine. Although they were stunned by his words, the thought that something new was again about to emerge exhilarated them. Shinichi then invited several of the key local members into the room. "The reason I asked you in here," he began, "is that today I intend to form a district in San Francisco. I therefore would like to ask Yukiko Gilmore to be the district chief and Chiyoko Taylor, the women's division, district chief." Both women nodded, their expressions tense. "Mrs. Gilmore will be the district leader, a position that is normally assigned to a man. However, I think it is perfectly acceptable for her to fulfill this position. Not only are there many women among the members here, but America is a country that stresses the equality of the sexes. Moreover, there is no discrimination in Buddhism. As Nichiren Daishonin states, there should be no discrimination among those who propagate the five characters of Myoho Renge Kyo in the latter day of the law, be they men or women. Therefore, it's not at all strange to have a woman in the position of district chief. If the two of you combine your energies and work together, you will be able to create a wonderful district." "I'll do my best. I'll fight with all my might." Each woman replied with firm resolve. The seed of Kōsun Rūfu had just been planted in their hearts. To the husbands of Yukiko Gilmore and Chiyoko Taylor, Shinichi then said, "I would also like to ask you, Daniel and Paul, to become advisors to the district. In addition to supporting your wives as you've been doing, I'd really appreciate it if you could warmly watch over the members of the district and, if need be, make yourself available for advice and assistance. Would you mind doing this?" Nagayasu Masaki, who was standing at Shinichi's side, translated this for them. Smiling, the two men nodded their agreement. Shinichi's companions, however, could not hide their astonishment. Daniel Gilmore seemed to have almost no knowledge of profound Buddhist doctrines, while Paul Taylor was not even a member. The idea of appointing the two as district advisors would never have entered the leaders' minds. Sensing the others' thoughts, Shinichi said promptly, "I want to treasure people like Paul, people who, though not practicing faith themselves, have a good understanding of the Soka Gakkai and lend their support to our activities. Nothing is more gratifying. I want to show my utmost appreciation and respect for their contribution. Many members tend to look at people simply in terms of whether they are practicing or not. If a person is a member, they feel reassured. If not, they feel uneasy. But this kind of thinking is wrong. It is not Buddhism. There are many fine people of upstanding character who don't practice. When we look at how these people live, we see much that accords with the Buddhist way of life. On the other hand, there are people who practice this faith yet cause trouble for their fellow members or society, or end up betraying the Soka Gakkai. Therefore, to think that those who practice are good and those who do not are bad is to make a terrible mistake. Indeed, I would even say it violates the principles of human rights. In Shinichi's mind, there was no wall separating the Soka Gakkai from society. In accord with the principle that Buddhism manifests itself in society, those who practice Buddhism should naturally yearn for the happiness of all people and peace throughout the world. Moreover, a great mountain that rises from a broad base is not easily destroyed, whereas a sheer cliff is fragile and easily crumbles. To firmly establish Kosen Rufu, the Soka Gakkai also needs to possess a solid base like a majestic mountain. Thus, the support of people outside the organization, people from every walk of life, has been important. Shinichi was also keenly aware that the very presence of such friends would clearly attest to the validity of the Dai Shonin's Buddhism as a religion that exists for the people. That brings us to the end of today's reading. I hope you have an amazing day.